BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcast. This is Year of the Iggy, a podcast series that tells the story of Iggy Pop over the course of a year. My name is Andy, and I'll be your host throughout this audio journey. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I'd encourage you to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Iggy. Also, remember to rate, like, and share the podcast with others that might enjoy it. On this month's episode, we take a deep dive into the events that helped shape the Stooges' monumental debut album. As discussed at the end of last episode, Elektra Records had interest in signing the Detroit-based band, the MC5s. In the fall of 1968, they sent their A&R rep, Danny Fields, to Michigan to finish up paperwork with the band. It was during that business trip that the MC5s suggested that while he was in town, he should also check out their relatively unknown kid brother band, the Psychedelic Stooges. Fields was blown away by what he witnessed at the show that afternoon. Reflecting on that first Psychedelic Stooges show, Fields said, quote, "I didn't know their songs, I couldn't recognize any intro or chord or anything. It was all pretty free form. It was like Beethoven was finally here, or Wagner. It was so solid and so modern and so non-blues. How long did it take me to recognize that this was something special? 5 seconds. After the set, he approached the band backstage.
I said, "Hi, I'm Danny Fields from Elektra Records. I really liked your act." And he didn't even look at me.
He approached me after the gig and said, "You're a star." And I thought, well, this guy wants to pick me up or something. I don't know, you know.
After speaking with the band, Fields called his boss, Jack Holzman, and told him that he had discovered the next big thing in music and that the label needed to sign them ASAP. Here's Fields reflecting on that phone call.
"I'm just going to call president of Elektra Records. And I said, I just saw two great bands. The one band is really popular around here. They have a following. They play to 2,000 or 3,000 people. And the other band is a little early stages of development. Jack just said, see if the big band will take 20,000 and the little band will take 5.
Holzman trusted Fields, but insisted that he see the band play before handing over a contract. A week later, he arrived in Ann Arbor with art director Bill Harvey to see if the band lived up to Fields' descriptions. In the days leading up to their make-or-break show at the Fifth Dimension Dance Club, Iggy became nervous. As a result, his childhood asthma crept up, causing more uncertainty about the performance. Using his anxiety as inspiration, Iggy wrote two new songs days before the show, the noisy art piece Asthma Attack and the song I'm Sick. Holzman didn't know what to make of the noisy, formless music, but he recognized the energy of the outlandish frontman. Fields said of Holzman's reaction after the show, quote, "He was completely stupefied by the Stooges." Years later, Holzman admitted that he gave the okay to sign the band to appease his young A&R rep, saying, quote, "Danny was very high on the Stooges, and I just said yes. I've always liked things that are odd and interesting, and they certainly fit that bill. But yes, the Stooges were an afterthought for Elektra Records." On October 4th, 1968, the band was handed a contract to sign with Elektra Records. Only there was one omission that surprised them. On the line that stated the band name, it simply said, The Stooges. Deciding it was a small item to quibble about, the newly christened Stooges signed the contract for $5,000.
Showbiz is not a friendly place. And I gotta say, of all the people that ever extended a hand to our group, the MC5 were probably the most genuine about it. As soon as we got signed, we started feeling more professional. I think we realized we didn't need to be the Psychedelic Stooges.
Before leaving, Fields tasked the band with writing more material, particularly songs that could translate that energy in album form. The songwriting process did not get off to a great start, as Iggy's weed intake continued to impact his asthma issues. As the band nursed their frontman with a macrobiotic diet and daily intakes of lotus root tea, they sent communique to Fields that their upcoming record date needed to be delayed. As Iggy healed, Ashton went to work on his guitar, coming up with some of the band's most iconic riffs to date.
That was when Ron's finest hour, when he came up over the next months with two great riffs. I Want to Be Your Dog and No Fun. So for a while, we just went out and played it, and I remember on both that one and No Fun, and members of the MC5 raising an eyebrow and going, you got a good riff there.
So messed up, I want you here. In my room, I want you here. Now we're gonna be face to face.
As months passed, Fields became nervous about the band he'd convinced the label to sign. He insisted that they send tapes to reassure him that they weren't just spending their days on the couch smoking pot. When he finally received the demo, he was blown away by I Want to Be Your Dog. He'd never heard anything like it.
The national anthem of punk rock. And this was before there was the word punk rock. It's 1968.
As Iggy became healthier, he began to contribute vocals and lyrics to Ashton's crushing riffs. For the song No Fun, he wanted to capture the spirit of the delinquent blues that he had envisioned a year earlier on the banks of the Chicago River.
And then the words were just, again, the words were an attempt. What we didn't want to do is sing a song like, oh baby, I'm gonna keep on rocking, and I'm gonna rock your pussy, and I'm gonna rock your little ears, and rock, rock, rock. Ugh. You know, that was right out. I wanted to make songs about how we were living in the Midwest, and what was this life about, and basically there was no fun and nothing to do. So I wrote about that.
No fun, my baby, no fun. No fun, my babe, no fun. No fun to hang around, feeling that same old way. No fun to hang around, freak out for another day.
The Stooges began testing their new material with the Ann Arbor scene and found that the music resonated with their audience. For one of these shows, Iggy decided to shave off his eyebrows. Afterwards, many of the locals began calling him Iggy Pop because he looked like a well-known local named Jim Pop who suffered from alopecia. As the band prepared for their upcoming recording session, Danny Fields was at work trying to find a producer for the debut album. He reached out to John Cale, best known for being the guitar player and songwriter for the influential band The Velvet Underground. Not only was Iggy a huge fan of the Velvets, but Cale's music fit right in line with the avant-garde stuff the Stooges were producing.
Waldo Jeffers had reached his limit. It was now mid-August. Jumenti had been separated from Marsha for more than 2 months. Months of all he had to show with three dog-eared letters and two very expensive long-distance phone calls. True, when school had ended and she'd returned to Wisconsin and come to Locust, Pennsylvania, she had sworn to maintain a certain fidelity. She would date occasionally, but merely as amusement. She would remain faithful. But lately, Waldo had begun to worry. He had trouble sleeping at nights. And when he did, he had horrible dreams. He lay awake at night, tossing and turning underneath his pleated quilt protector, tears welling in his eyes as he pictured Marcia, her sworn vows overcome by Rika and the smooth soothings of some Neanderthal, finally submitting to the final caresses of sexual oblivion.
Before agreeing to work with the Stooges, John Cale wanted to make sure they were a band he'd like to have his name associated with. A few weeks later, he flew to Detroit to catch a Stooges show, and he was left speechless by their performance. Here's Cale remembering the blistering set.
What I was concerned about with the Stooges was, having seen the show, the volatility of that show live, and how great it was, and the twisted emotions that go on through the show. And one minute you're being threatened, another minute you're being embraced. Yeah, I mean, really wonderful entertainment. How was I going to get that on a record?
Yeah, I guess.
After the show, Cale went to the Funhouse to meet with the band. He was quickly taken aback by the primitive abode. Recalling that night, he said, quote, "I opened the refrigerator to see dozens of bottles of Bud and no food. I said, 'What do you fucking eat?' And Iggy said, 'Whatever, you know.'" Despite the band's minimalist home, Cale was charmed by their personalities and outlook on life. He soon after agreed to produce their debut. Weeks later, the Michigan natives arrived in New York City to begin laying down tracks. The band took to the Big Apple like ducks to water.
We loved it. We loved it. The whole group loved New York. There were things in that environment that didn't really exist for a young person in the Midwest.
To help the band acclimate to the New York culture, Danny Fields and John Cale wined and dined them, taking them to hip clubs like Max's Kansas City, The Scene, and Andy Warhol's Factory. While Dave Alexander and the Ashtons were hesitant about the gender-bending, flamboyant personalities, Iggy instantly fit in. Reflecting on that time, Fields said, quote, "He was born sophisticated and confident. He was a star before he was a star. He was Iggy. By that time, he was already famous in the back room of Max's." Here's Iggy discussing his appreciation for the New York art scene at that time.
There were these sort of open-minded, devil-may-care, academic refugees, I called them. And the young ones, like Lee Black Childers and Glenn O'Brien and Eric Anderson, who was an actual Warhol star, these people should have been working for the Kennedys.
While New York City's club scene was exciting for the young stoners, they also noticed a darker side to the city's landscape.
When I got to New York with the Stooges in 69, it was a very dark and downtrodden area. If you sat on a park bench there for more than 15 minutes, somebody would offer you drugs or sex or both.
Mainstream music in 1969 was all about love, peace, and happiness. Iggy realized that the message didn't match up with what he was seeing on the streets of New York. As a result, he penned lyrics for the anti-hippie track, 1969, taking aim at empty sentiments.
Well, it's 1969, okay. Walk across the USA. It's another year for me and you. Another year with nothing to do. It's another year for me and you. Another year with nothing to do. Now last year I was 21. I didn't have a lot of fun. I say oh my and a boo-hoo. Yeah, now I'm gonna be 22. Oh my and a boo-hoo. Well, it's 1969, okay. Walk across the USA.
On April Fool's Day, 1969, the Stooges entered the Hit Factory recording studio to begin working on their debut, but the process would have a rocky start. The studio engineer informed the band they would have to use smaller amps because studio owner Jerry Ragovic didn't want to disturb the businesses below. The band threw a fit. Iggy recalls telling him, quote, "I don't care who the fuck Jerry Ragovic is. You don't know anything about this." Then Ron Ashton instructed the band to stage a sit-in, cross-legged in a corner of the studio, smoking hash until they were allowed to play their music at the volume they saw best suited for their sound. Finally, John Cale came up with a solution.
And we had a struggle. We recorded it with John Cale producing. And John's a great personality and a great producer too, but he wanted us,
you guys really need to turn down your amps.
You know, and these are just, we're kids from the Midwest. We've never even been to New York. And we had to turn down our amps, man. So we didn't, you know, finally we turned them to 9.
During the first few days in the studio, the Ashtons and Dave Alexander struggled to find their groove while laying down backing tracks. Iggy, ever the ringleader, took matters into his own hands and took charge of the situation.
These are very inward guys, and I noticed that when I would dance around the room in rehearsal, up went the energy like fire.
With their amps set to 9 and Iggy dancing out the tempo, the band knocked out 6 songs in only a couple days. John Cale was shocked and impressed by their professionalism.
We had 10 days, whatever it was we were going to get on the record, we had 10 days. And the band came in, set up, slammed it. Then time for Iggy to do the vocals. He comes up to me, hands me a sheaf of papers. And I said, "What's that?" He said, "The lyrics." And I said, "Whoa." And off he went, hit all the vocals. And we got on to mixing it. I mean, very professional.
Really?
Not too many takes. No, they were ready. They slashed. I mean, you can feel that kind of energy on the record anyway.
When label head Jack Holzman came into the studio to hear the first demos, he was disappointed. "Where are the songs?" he asked, referring to the fact that tracks like Asthma Attack and We Will Fall were extended sound explorations. Not wanting to disappoint the studio, the band came up with a little fib.
No song was under 8 minutes, and the company got it and went, "We can't release this. There's not enough songs. They're too long and nothing's happening." So we just lied and we said, "Oh, we have more songs. Book us more time." And we wrote 3 or 4 songs real fast in the Chelsea Hotel.
When the Stooges returned to the Hotel Chelsea that night, they scrambled to write 3 more songs. Within an hour, they'd come up with the songs Little Doll, Not Right, and Real Cool Time. For the song Little Doll, the band drew inspiration from one of Iggy's favorite jazz songs at that time, Pharoah Sanders' Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. As you'll notice, the bass lines are almost identical. As the band finished up the remaining tracks on the album, Iggy Pop was shocked to see German singer and Velvet Underground collaborator Nico in the control room next to John Cale, knitting as the Stooges wailed away in the studio.
And John wore a big cape like Dracula, great big hooded cape, black velvet with a pink velour inside, and he brought this chick Nico up with him, So the two of them would sit there like, it was kind of like the Addams Family. It just hadn't come, it was like a Mr. and Mrs. Monster or something. And they would sit there and she would sit there knitting and going, yeah, yeah, this is good. It's better than the Velvet.
Nico became instantly smitten with the young frontman, and over the course of the next several days in New York, Iggy was rarely seen without her hanging on his arm.
A young smartass rock singer trying to make an impression in New York City, and hanging out with a kind of a very lost girl.
When the recording sessions finally came to a close, Nico insisted that she return to Michigan with Iggy to continue their burgeoning relationship. One can only imagine what the German model thought when she entered the pigsty that was the Funhouse. She quickly made her presence known, reviving the young miscreants with her organic cooking and educating them on high-end wine. She also taught the young Iggy Pop a few lessons in the bedroom.
Iggy, can we talk about Nico? I think you were quite close. You, Nico, la chanteuse Nico, qui est morte cet été.
She taught me the first time I ever had a Beaujolais. That was from Nico. Before that, I just had like Ripple, you know this.
Yeah. Iggy, la première fois où il a bu du Beaujolais, c'est Nico, la chanteuse du Velvet Underground, qui l'avait branché.
And one, she taught me how to eat pussy.
Et elle lui a également appris à lui faire des gâteries avec sa langue.
She said one day, you know, there is something very nice you could do for me would make me feel very good.
Un jour, elle lui a dit, tu pourrais faire quelque chose pour moi qui te ferait vraiment plaisir.
So she showed me about that, which was a good thing to learn.
Et elle lui a expliqué, c'était une bonne chose à savoir.
As the band awaited the eventual release of their debut album in a couple months, they began playing the festival circuit, bringing their innovative sound beyond the borders of Michigan. Nico joined the band as they toured, and her energy brought out an even more primal side to Iggy's stage presence.
Not a long period of time that I spent together with her, maybe a month, I don't know. But it was important for me, and something about her presence that kept me constantly edgy, and I had some of my most dangerous and some pretty nasty shows. And a couple of them were stopped by the police. When we were working in Michigan, she was coming with me to the shows. I don't know what that was, whether I was trying to impress her or some influence. I'm not sure.
An example of Iggy pushing the envelope that summer occurred at a show in Delaware, Ohio, where Iggy picked up a broken drumstick from the stage and began slashing his chest with it, leaving a trail of flesh wounds as the unsuspecting audience looked on in horror. Between their weekend festival gigs, the band returned to the Funhouse with Nico in tow. When a scheduled music video shoot for her song, Evening of Light, approached, she informed the director and film crew that there was a change of plans on filming location. Several days later, Francois de Manil and his crew arrived at the Funhouse farm to film Nico as she roamed through the Michigan cornfields. She even asked the Stooges to appear in the music video, faces painted in white as they carried a cross across the prairie. You can check the video out over at BDWPS. It's a sight to behold.
A true story wants to be mine. A true story wants to be mine. The story is telling a true lie. The story is telling a true lie. Mandolins are ringing, tulips violet singing. Mandolins are ringing, tulips violet singing.
Days after the video shoot, Iggy woke up to find that Nico was gone. The only thing she left behind was an Indian shawl with a thank you note. Iggy wasn't surprised. He knew he was just a minor escape for the troubled artist.
A very lost and fragile personality who was basically, I think she was probably on the rebound from, she didn't really have any relations with the Velvet Underground anymore. She wasn't a top model anymore. She was just kind of floating around. And I think there'd been an affair with this one, with that one, with whatever musicians, and I happened in there, and in my way. I loved her in my way. I had a great admiration for her, and not a long period of time that I spent together with her, maybe a month.
The Stooges' debut self-titled album was released August 6th, 1969, but would be overshadowed by a much bigger event happening in the world of music.
This is one reason Max Yasker's neighbors are upset because he leased his farm to a rock music festival. This is another. More than 350,000 people, mostly young people, showed up to hear the greatest rock groups in the country. The promoters billed it as 3 days of peace and music. And for most people, it was just that. Little thanks to the promoters. There were many problems, like not enough sanitation facilities, food, or water. Good morning.
The irony of their loud, brash album being released on the same day as a festival of peace and love was not lost on Iggy Pop.
It went down really well and made a very strong impression on a certain minority. And it upset the shit out of the new age corporate structure to be, all of whom had, you know, beards and long hair. They hated us because a whole new set of people were going to come in and beautify America in a peaceful, psychedelic way and take over, and it was all a complete lie. And we were kind of messing up the program, and we didn't really realize it. We didn't set out to do that.
It was pretty clear from the album's sales that the Stooges weren't made for the age of the Flower Child. The music on the radio was peaceful and full of hope for a better future. The Stooges were anything but that. The critics also struggled to wrap their head around the new sounds emanating from Ann Arbor. Robert Christgau of the Village Voice backhandedly called it stupid rock at its best. Edmund O. Ward of Rolling Stone wrote the following screed. Iggy sings in a blatantly poor imitation of an early Mick Jagger. The instrumentalists sound like they've been playing their axes for 2 months and playing together for 1 month at most. And they just love wah-wah and fuzz, just like rank amateur groups. The lyrics are subliterate, their music is loud, boring, tasteless, unimaginative, and childish. He then finished his rambling diatribe of insults with the following contradictory sentence. I kind of like it.
So we will have a real cool time. I said we will have a real cool time tonight. I said we will have a real cool time tonight. I said we will have a real cool time. We will have a real cool time. A real cool time.
Although the album only sold 32,000 copies in its first year, it has gone on to be considered a classic and a cornerstone of what would become the punk rock movement. In 2012, Rolling Stone placed the Stooges' debut at number 185 on their top 500 albums of all time list, saying the album, quote, savagely gave the lie to hippie idealism. In the book 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die, Robert Dimmery included the album saying it was, quote, a collection of brilliant curios, which were neither full-on garage rock nor out-and-out dirge. And in 2005, Q Magazine placed I Wanna Be Your Dog at number 13 in its list of the 100 greatest guitar tracks of all time. Needless to say, it took the public a few years, or even decades, to catch up with what the Stooges had concocted in the Funhouse.
No one on earth played that way at that time. Only us. Nobody rocked as hard as us. Nobody.
The debut album may not have been a success, but with such little investment in the band, Elektra Records didn't pressure the Stooges too much. However, by the end of 1969, the pressures of adulthood would become a major concern for a young Iggy Pop. A 21-year-old Iggy Pop becomes both a father and a husband on the next Year of the Iggy. If you enjoyed today's episode and don't want to wait another month for the next installment, go check out the other seasons of the Year of the Podcast series. For the David Bowie story, search Year of the Bowie. For the Neil Young story, search Year of the Neil. For the Joni Mitchell story, search Year of the Joni. And for the Stevie Wonder story, search Year of the Stevie. All four seasons are available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also check out my monthly podcast called BDWPS Podcast, where I play some of my favorite new music coming from the underground. If you are interested in exploring any of the interviews, songs, or research materials used in this episode, a works cited list can be found at bdwps.com. Also, remember to follow us at BDWPS on Twitter and Instagram for the latest podcast news. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in a month.